We're going to start with an exercise again. We always do. Those who have been to the trainings before know I always do some kind of exercise. So if you all would break yourselves into two groups, and what we're going to do is discuss a situation that we have had where we have made a cultural faux pas, and it was out of our mouth that we couldn't take it back. It was just out there, and we didn't know what to do about it. And I will give you an example of one that I witnessed but was not a part of. I was doing a training with a young woman who is a Puerto Rican woman, but fair skin, black skin texture. And someone came up to her after or at the break, 10:30, we were cold training, and said to her, "All right, what are you?" And she said, "I beg your pardon, what are you? You don't, you look white, but you sound black, and your mannerisms are black. So exactly what are you?" So, that kind of thing. So, okay, why don't we just take about 10 minutes to do that?
I'd like it to be good to have one person tell their story to the whole group so that we can kind of get an example of a cultural faux pas. Maybe it's something that you did that you kind of would not mind sharing with the whole group. Can I get anybody to volunteer to do that?
I'll volunteer mine. And I'll shorten it. I do a one-man play that has the language of the play is all poetry, and one of the words said three different times, written by a black writer, is nigger. And I put this play on pretty much all over the Midwest and never had any problems with it. And I asked black friends and black students of mine if I should leave these words in as they are, and they all said yes. And then at Holden Village in 1987, I did this, just a couple excerpts without any introduction. It was an encore situation. I just went out there quick and did it. And I used that word. There was one black woman in the audience. And 2 days later, she sought me for found me. She said, "I've been looking for you for two days to say, I don't let my daughter use that word." And this is, and just really explained to me very forcefully, with anger, all understandable. And the faux pas, I suppose, I mean, it's complicated as I see it, but primarily is, if you're white, you can just assume that when we confront other people that they trust us, that they expect us to do them fairly. And if you come from another culture that's been oppressed and been mistreated, that trust isn't an automatic thing. And so why would this black woman think that this white honky up there doing poetry would do it with love and respect? I mean, she doesn't know that. And so she's offended. As a major faux pas. More than a faux pas.
That's kind of some of the things I wanted to get into today. And what I'm going to do is kind of take you through this woman's pamphlet. It's called Cultural Etiquette, A Guide for the Well-Intentioned. And it's written by Amulja Three Rivers, who is a black Native American woman. And a lot of times, I teach an urban studies program in the city of Chicago, and I deal with young people. And a lot of times, they come into the city of Chicago, and they get paralyzed about what they can say and what they can't say, what they can do, what they can't do, how they will make mistakes, that they only have 15 to 20 weeks to be in a place. And if you make some major mistake, you can be ostracized and cut off for a good month or two, or maybe even your whole internship placement. And so what we try to do is kind of a sensitivity training in terms of sensitizing people to language and culture in the first 3 to 4 weeks that they're there. And this has been a good tool for me to just kind of set the parameters of what we're going to be talking about and what we're going to be dealing with in everyday life. First thing I want to talk about is racial identity and the right to define, and that's what it really comes down to, the right to define who you are and what you are. And so there are a lot of people who go back in time and called black people Negroes, and we talked about that. Or I have one, had one young student who came in, and she was from Hawaii, and she couldn't understand why she could refer to people as people of color and couldn't call them colored people. To her, there was no difference. She didn't understand the difference between the history of the two different terms, one being a term that was forced on you, and another being a term that you used to define yourself. So I kind of just want to take you very briefly through some basic stuff. African American. I think that that's a term that is most accepted today when you're talking about black people.
Get my notes.
And it's a term that's most accepted today when you're talking about black people. And it's because we as black people were cut off from our cultural heritage. And so it's very important for us that we make that link back to Africa. And so African American gives us a sense of identity of who we are, of what we came from, of our origins, and of our history. And that's important because that's something that was taken from us in slavery and something that we had to really struggle to get back and get back in a positive way. And so that's why the term African American is such, it's also a term of empowerment. Afro-American, some of you may remember that from the 60s, that was kind of the first kind of link to the motherland, our mother continent. It was just kind of the first defining of ourselves. Oh, you don't need to take Laura out.
She's just going to be noisy.
But it's okay. She can be noisy. She's not bothering anyone.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
And if she gets noisier, we'll talk louder. It's okay.
And we can compete.
Exactly. And Afro-American was kind of our first reaching out into the roots of the 60s, and that's where kind of the Afro-American term came from. And the African-American is even a progression, more of an evolution into that connection that we make with Africa as our motherland. Black American, I think, or blacks is a term that people use and people are very comfortable with. And I think that when you're talking to someone who is African-American, black, you can see what term they use. That's my kind of best guideline to you. See what term they use. And if they use black, then you use black. And if they use African-American, then you use African-American. Just kind of take your cues from the folks who you're talking to. And Peter Jennings did a very interesting thing. He was at a conference, and he was the keynote speaker at Howard University last year. And he was standing in front of all of these black students, and he kept saying African-American, and kept just kind of getting intertwined lips were going, and you know. And then he kept saying black, and then he finally said about, 15 minutes into his address, he said, "I want to stop this here." He said, "I am a Canadian person," he said, and he said, "I'm having some real problems." And again, he said, "I have this problem every time I come and speak to a group like yours of what do you want to be called? If you would prefer to be called African American, I will call you that. If you would prefer to be called black, I will call you that. But I need for you to define for me what you would like to be called right now, because I'm struggling with it, and it's making me uncomfortable, and I'm getting sidetracked from what I'm trying to do." And I thought that was a very good way to put it on the table. And you did it very well, and the students were very responsive. And so they kind of took off on this half an hour, 45 minute discussion on black versus African American, but all in a very positive way and good feedback.
What did they end up with?
They ended up with, they said he could interchange the terms. And that was fine with them. I'm not going to talk about some of the other terms because I really don't feel like I can really do them justice, but there are a couple of things that I'm going to touch on in terms of other ethnic terms, Latino and Latina.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure, stop me at any time.
Do black Americans, are they offended when white people call each other whites, or would they prefer that we call each
I read some articles that said that maybe Euro-Americans would be a better term.
I have not had that discussion where people said they felt offended by that. It's strange that you bring that up, because the times where I have heard it discussed is in groups with white men, where they are kind of in a snit, and they want their own term. They're going to be Euro-Americans. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're African-Americans, then I'm a Euro-American kind of. That's the only time that I've heard it used that, you know, that way. But my experience is limited to that, so I really don't know. Latino and Latina. This term is important, and I talked to, because this is something that I struggled with. I struggled with Hispanic versus Latino, Latina. And so I went to the Latino Institute in the city of Chicago, and I was very purposeful in doing this. And I said, I'd like to come and talk to you about language, because I don't really feel that I want to go to any of my friends who are Latinos and say, what is the term you prefer? I don't want to make them have to speak for Latinos and Latinas. I'd like to know what the official position is on the term. And what I was told is that Latina and Latino was a self-empowerment term in the same way that African American is a self-empowerment term. And that it is a way that they define who they are, and it's a way that is more inclusive than the term Hispanic. The term Hispanic was developed by the federal government in the 1980s for the purpose of the census. And so Latino, Latina is the term. Also, I just kind of would like to bring out the term of Oriental versus Asian, and that most people prefer to be called Asian because of the negative stereotype that comes up when you use the word Oriental, kind of that mystic, passive stereotype that has come up through American history. And also, Asian also is a term that is self-defining. It's a term of self-determination. People of color, because you hear that a lot. And what does that mean? Those are the black, brown, yellow, and red people who have all been oppressed, who come together in a bond of oppression and define themselves as people of color, recognizing that their oppression is different, but that they have some common history and some common bond in terms of oppression. Third world. This is a term that really can be a landmine. And I will tell you my own history on this term. In 1978, I was young 20s, I went to a conference called the World Game Workshops, and it was with a person named Buckminster Fuller, who was an industrial engineer. And they were discussing energy conservation on a global scale, and solar energy, and social justice issues. And they kept referring to me as a woman, a third world woman. And I kept saying to them, who gives you the right to define me as a third world woman? And are you saying that you are first world and that I'm third world? What's the implication behind calling me a third world woman? What do you mean by that? And then I even went so far as to say, and so what's the second world if you all are first world? And it turns out that first world was the United States and Russia and some other folks, the European, the white. And the third world for folks were all people of color. And just kind of the whole defining of that somehow or another makes it seem like that I as a person would be inferior, and that my motherland, that the place that I put my cultural roots would be inferior by the terming of third world. So those are just kind of some basics on kind of what to call people and, you know, what to look out for.
Could I interject something?
Yes.
One, I mean, it just reminded me, you talking about that, a term I've been hearing lately that I think is positive, and listening to people talk about in tapes and reading about, is indigenous peoples. Mm-hmm. And I, do you have a comment on that?
My only comment on that is that we work with a number of Native American groups, mm-hmm. and the issue really became hot in the city of Chicago around the issue of Columbus Day and the Quincentennial, mm-hmm. and that they are the people who were here. Mm-hmm. They were not discovered, and this is their, you know, and so that whole thing, and also again, an empowerment term. We are indigenous, we were not brought here. We are the people who were here. And so that, and I think it is a positive and a very empowering term for them to say we are the indigenous people.
Actually, Columbus Day was the day that the Indians discovered Columbus invading their land. So here's the way that they put it.
I'll give you another example, if you don't mind me telling these personal stories. Columbus Day celebration, the Quincentennial celebration in Chicago, was a very heated one. And we had 58 students who come from small towns. The majority of them are white, very privileged, middle-class kids. And we were trying to get them to examine the issue of Columbus and the discovery, quote unquote. And so in order to do this, we took them to a number of places. We took them to the American Indian Center, which is the cultural, the oldest American Indian cultural center in the country. And they talked about what their issues were, and they talked about how it played out in life, that they were not discovered. And they talked about how they were portrayed. And a very interesting discussion came up about the sports teams and what that meant, you know, the Atlanta Braves doing the Tommy Hawk thing and the Washington Redskins. And she put it in a way that I will never forget. And she said, you know, how many of you don't think that's an important issue? A lot of people said, well, with poverty and everything else that you have to worry about, we just don't see why you would waste your time on this. And she said, wouldn't you be offended if they were called the Washington Black Faces, and at halftime people came out wearing African costumes and throwing spears? Or, you know, if they were called the somebody White Faces, and, you know, they came out and did something else. And so she put it into a context where, put yourself in that person's position, and you can see why this is offensive and why we have to work on it. Kind of thing. So anyway, in our experience with the Native American, how he was a hero to them, and how they had fought very hard to get Columbus Day as a national holiday, and it was because that there was a lot of ethnic hate at that time, and they felt that they needed their own national holiday. However, when questioned about the students very pointedly about what does that do to the Native Americans who were already here, they made some very interesting comments. And the feedback that we got from the students was that we had deliberately set the Italian Americans up to make them look bad, to make them look like they were racist, because, mm-hmm. you know, the way we had actually had them see Native Americans and Italian Americans made them, because they were able to ask the right questions at that point, made it look like the Italian Americans were deliberately set up to be the bad guys. So that's kind of a story to itself. The term exotic. Talk about the term exotic. Anybody want to tell me, have you ever used that term to describe somebody?
Some people call me exotic all the time. I'm not sure what they mean.
You're close to Iraq.
I'm not really sure what that means either. And why?
I think it means not as white as them.
Yes.
I think that's what it means.
Yes. And I think that's why it becomes a term that sends up a red flag. And when you start talking about somebody who looks very exotic, you know, that means that they have a beauty, but it's not recognized within what your sphere of beauty is. It's recognized as somebody else's beauty.
Also, when it's applied to things besides people, it usually means something that's very rare.
Mm-hmm.
And so it has, you know, it's a term that can turn, I think, depending on the context in which it's used. That sometimes it does mean strange or bizarre or not understandable, and sometimes it means rare and precious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because exotic flowers, orchids, are something that you have to take very careful care of in order that you have this that's sought after. And so it's a term that it's a slippery one.
Yes, it is. Yeah, but usually when it's applied to people, yep. It means that you have something that we recognize the value of, but it's outside what we value, but we recognize that there is a value.
Having her put that in that context, in Black literature, or African-American literature, the whole history around the 20s and the 30s that made white people attracted to the Black dance halls and music halls that Black people couldn't go to, but white people could, and the performers were Black. Exotic was the word used over and over again, and it really meant a special kind of exclusion, mm-hmm. a special kind of Jim Crow forced upon them and stuff. So exotic in that historically has only a bad context.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Ethnic. Do we use that term a lot?
Mm-hmm.
The only point that she makes, and so I'm going to steal her point, and that is that Margaret Thatcher is as much an ethnic as Miriam Makeba.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think people tend to remember that when they use the term. Technology and supremacy. Now, this
a negative term?
No, but it should not only be used to refer to people of color.
Well, actually, my field of study has to do with ethnicity, but I work with European American immigrants. And frequently what you find with the term ethnic is that ethnic, until quite recently, was used to distinguish between kinds of Europeans. So that it's a more subtle differentiation that's being made among Europeans, and that other distinctions then are racial distinctions. Right? So that there are, it's almost like a subcategory of a race, but it's a subcategorization that in social scientific circles was only being made for Europeans.
Until
quite recently. And so it's a sometimes now people use, I think, the word ethnic when they don't want to say race, because
mm-hmm.
they know there's something kind of scary about that. They don't know if they know they're going to do that right. So it's like using gender instead of sex.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds better somehow.
I
don't know that it's necessarily a negative term,
yeah.
But it's a neutral term which has, like a mushroom, absorb what's around it.
Well, I don't think it is a negative term. I think that we have to watch how we use it. And kind of what I'm doing is kind of taking you through a number of terms that people use a lot that send up signals for other people. Like this is kind of, it's a guide for the well-intentioned. You know, if you're a racist, you don't care if you use the right term or not. You don't care if you're going to defend somebody. So we're just kind of trying to go through that. Well, let's talk about the other term that will raise a flag, minority. Now, we all use the term minority. I use it a lot. I have to stop myself from using it a lot. And it's becoming a big term as we become more global. And I'm thinking we have to know that people of color are not the minority. And it became an issue in Chicago in 1987 when we elected our first Black mayor, and we were not the minority. We were the majority in the city of Chicago. And felt good. You know, I gotta tell you, it really did feel good not to be the minority anymore. You know, just kind of empowering kind of thing. And so the term, we have to look at how we're using the term minority and majority and in what context. Because if we're talking globally, if we're talking about world issues, then the white race is not in the majority anymore. They are in the minority. And if we're talking about, you know, situations of power, we have to examine those situations of power a lot more closely than we did in the past. So that's a term that we just need to kind of be more aware of as we use it. Technology supremacy. Words like backwards, primitive, uncivilized, savage, barbaric, underdeveloped, all of those words and the connotations that they have. And I was at a conference very recently on cultural diversity. And they were talking about something that was kind of strange to me. They were talking about teaching the canon. And what that means is that when you teach a course, there are certain classics that you have to teach. And so there was this whole discussion of at least a whole day of should they include, and I just thought this was fascinating in terms of language, should they include some of the primitive works in terms of artwork, some of the primitives, should they, and just language was just so incredible about how they talked about the works of people of color, and especially in arts and literature. And I'm sure Paul, you get a lot of that saying, the criticism about does actually, if you put in someone of color, is that debasing your curriculum?
Yeah, you just don't take out Hemingway and stick in Wright.
Exactly. Those kinds of issues. Literacy. Now, this one is a good one because I was on the way here. I took the train from Chicago. And this is where we kind of value traditions that are written, but we don't value traditions that are oral. And sometimes I really wonder what that's about, to be honest. And the article I read on the way here was that Thomas Jefferson, there's this big article in Ebony Magazine, Thomas Jefferson had fathered some children by a black slave woman. And the tradition had been passed orally that they were the descendants of Thomas Jefferson. And there are like 100 and some of these folks who get together every year who have all had the same story passed to them generation through generation. Well, the Jeffersonian historians invited them to come to the manor to have their reunion, but did it because they wanted to acknowledge that they were indeed on the plantation, but would not validate that their oral history had any value other than the fact that it put them on the plantation. Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting to me that it's okay that the oral history put them on the plantation, but it's not okay that the oral history made them descendants of Jefferson. So somewhere along there, I kind of got lost in that. What
some of my best friends are. Kind of.
Yeah, exactly. Or can you prove? You know, a lot of times they say, "Can you prove?" And how do I prove it? Is you have to prove it in my standards. You know, you have to prove it the way I would prove it, or I don't feel it's valid. And to label certain cultures as good and as smart because they have a written tradition and others don't.
That's going on right now with the Southeast Asian community.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. Mm-hmm.
A large radio. Seeing the kids with the large radios that they're getting. Boombox.
Seen those?
What are they?
Boombox.
Any other names you've heard?
Ghetto blaster.
Yeah,
oh, ghetto blaster.
Not a ghetto blaster. I heard the name to bring that up. And they are, they're stereos, they're record players, but they are not boomboxes. And this is a part of the section that this woman calls for your information. I just think it's really cute. So FYI, everybody can blush, bruise, tan, or be sunburned. FYI, no matter how dark, we can all do that. Okay. Natural rhythm. I do hope that everybody has a natural rhythm. Really hope, you know, you do. You know, yours might be different from mine, but I think you got one. And if you don't have one, I'm sorry. But, you know, I have mine, you have yours, let's just recognize that. Hair. And we have to talk about hair because that certainly is one of the things that has been passed down since slavery. And so many times I hear people talking about good hair and bad hair. Have we heard of these terms? Have we heard these terms as people talk about, oh God, she's got bad hair. How is she combing? Oh God, did you see her hair? It was just really good hair. That woman, she was a black woman and she had good hair. It looked like she had a natural body weight. And I think it's because she was mixed with white. And folks say that a lot, you know, and so this whole term of good hair and bad hair, well, all hair is good. If you got some, it's good.
Okay. Yeah, I agree with
dreadlocks. Do we all know what dreadlocks are? Dreadlocks.
I just found out a week ago.
It's a style of hair that if you wash your hair and don't comb it daily, your hair automatically locks into a certain pattern. Once it locks, it's a natural locking and it cannot be unlocked. And it is a way that people wear their hair when they're making a cultural statement. Jamaicans, for example, and some Jamaican cultures, Rastafarians, kind of have a stereotype. That's the stereotype that we think of when we see dreadlocks. They're Jamaican, Rastafarian drug dealers.
My sister, who has red hair, tried dreadlocks for a while. They were sort of artificial, but she had dreadlocks. It looked sort of interesting, but she couldn't get out of it.
Okay.
But just, it's not all. Or at least I guess that was the style, or it's becoming more and more the style.
Well, didn't it originate from the Jamaicans and the Rastafarians?
Yes, it did. But now it's become, it's broadened so that it's...
Where does the word dread itself, is a funny word for it, where does that come from? I mean, is that, if it's dreadlock that we think of dread, it's negative connotations from go.
You know...
Is it connected to that or is there something else?
I don't know where the dread part locks. Came, but I do know that the lock part came because of the locking of the hair and the way it attached to the other parts, but I don't know.
But it's not something that we just dread.
No, and I think it comes out of Rastafari.
Yeah.
D-R-E-D, not D-R-E-A.
D-R-E-D.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah.
Oh,
Maybe it has to do with dread scar.
Yeah.
And locks or hair is sometimes referred to as locks.
Right.
Locks
exactly.
Of hair.
So just so that I can point this out, and that is that all Jamaicans are not Rastafari. And all Rastafarians are not Jamaicans, so we just need to kind of say that before we move on. This is one that's really kind of hit home in my family. Skin color. And people's natural curiosity about skin color. There are seven of us. We range from darker than me to very fair skin. And people have done a number of things to me and my family when we were out. Even though we look, our features, we look very much alike. People don't recognize them at first, they see the skin tone. And so I was visiting my sister one day at her job, and she said, I want you to meet my sister. And the guy said, where is she, Diane? Where is she? I'm sitting right there. Here. right here. And so, I mean, it's just the kind of thing. And this whole thing that happens to me a lot, and I don't know if this happens to people randomly, so I'll throw it out. Maybe you can tell me it happens to you, and maybe I'm being oversensitive about it. That when I'm in certain situations, people just naturally assume I work there. If I'm in a department store, I have to be working there.
It happens to me all the time.
Okay. And could you get that down from me, from Michelle? Right.
All the time. I think we look or act like people in authority or something. Yeah. I mean, all the time. I work everywhere because people always come up.
That's interesting. There's three women that say that. That's never happened to me.
Oh, it's happened to me quite often.
I think it's even in a hardware store.
Or
a
block at a
hardware store, yeah.
But it happens to me all the time. Or, I'll give you another one, to go in with a colleague and he will say, this is Dorothy and we work together. And they'll say,
are you his secretary?
Yeah.
Or in my department office, if I'm in the office and a student comes in, they assume that I'm the secretary and that I know where all my colleagues are.
Mm-hmm. And then I will give you one that really just is kind of weird to me. I have a friend named Ian who is married to a white man, and they had a son recently, and her son looks very white, and she has prematurely gray hair. She was out with her son. Someone came up to her and said, aren't you lucky to be able to keep him? You know, I'm sure the parents must be very proud, and you just must really be lucky to be able to keep this child. She said, he is my child. I am his mother. This is not someone else's kid, you know. This whole kind of, you must be the child care worker out with this white kid kind of thing. So
that's a wonderful thought.
I'm talking about. Here's one that I think, I'm just going to read it because I think this one is important. People do not have a hard time because of their race or cultural background. No one is attacked, abused, oppressed, enslaved because of their race or cultural background. People are attacked, abused, oppressed, or enslaved because of racism. Now, what's the distinction between them?
Who's responsible?
Exactly. Not only who's responsible, but the first implies that there's a shortcoming of some sort. You know, that if you have been attacked, abused, oppressed, maybe there's something wrong with you. You know, so just kind of a subtle distinction there. Urban neighborhoods, you know, have a lot of students who really hate the urban neighborhoods. You know, well, you know, when we go to the Southwest Side, which is a white ethnic pocket in the city of Chicago, and they talk about how they didn't leave the South Side of the city of Chicago because of racism. They left it because of economics, and they had worked their whole lives for homes, and they had to make sure that they could have that investment when they retired. And so the students come away sometimes with the experience that, yeah, there does go the neighborhood. You know, there goes the neighborhood. They come in, the neighborhood has declined, and we don't talk about why the neighborhood declined. We don't talk about racist policies that make the neighborhood decline. We don't talk about the pulling out of city services that are necessary to any neighborhood. We don't talk about insurance redlining or bank redlining or any of these other things. The drug problem. I'm just kind of running through these, so I know this sounds a little crazy as I'm going through, but I hope you can get something out of it as you think back on it. The drug problem. And the 500,000 years of African cultures, we have never had a drug problem until we brought here. You know, just kind of keep that in your mind. That's kind of all I want to say about that. Another one that kind of goes on with the story about Ken and her son. Somehow or another, the impression gets out there that people who do daycare and who are maids and who are chauffeurs do this because they have some kind of different sense of loyalty. You know, that they are almost like animals in this loyalty, that they truly do love the folks that they work for, and given the opportunity to do something better, wouldn't even do it because they couldn't bear to leave these folks. One thing that has, and this is kind of my soapbox issue, and I don't think a lot of people feel as strongly about this as me, and that is to kind of romanticize the oppression that Black people have gone through. I am really enraged, and I will say that, about the series Queen. I am enraged because of the way that it started. I am not going to let anyone tell me that the white slave master had a love affair with a Black woman when she went into the fields every day. I think that's a romanticized version of what really happened. The fact that she had her own cabin, that he visited, that, you know, all of these kind of nicety kind of things happen. So that's my own soapbox issue that I talk about.
Is that a television series?
Yes.
Oh, I don't know.
And it's stuff that happens all the time where people will say to me, you know, Georgia, did you see the series on blah, 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 blah? Because, you know, slavery wasn't that bad. You know, if you really look at it, they had their own hunts. And, you know, other people were living badly, too. You know, kinds of things. And, you know, I just kind of that romanticized. And it's not just with Blacks that we do it. I think we do it a lot with Native Americans. You know, we kind of romanticize their experience instead of seeing it as how savage that the experience really was.
I just throw out to us that I don't know, I wish I did, the effects of this book on history majors in college. But a guy named Ulrich Phillips wrote what was at that time, 1919, kind of the definitive book on American slavery. And he was white, and he's got something like 400 footnotes in that book. The title of it is American Negro Slavery, and not one of his footnotes refers to a Black writer. So here's the guy describing it, and I think of that book because he uses the word, I mean, anyone that reads it, I guess, does, he doesn't, romantic. Mm-hmm. This is a real unique thing. I mean, it's Happy Sambo sitting on the fence, mm-hmm. lolling right. with his bare feet, mm-hmm. not having to go to school, and fishing with his pole, and life is cool.
Mm-hmm.
And he, again, I don't know the effect of that, and what other kinds of history teachers, but I remember a history teacher of mine saying, you know, a great guy, a role model for me in my life forever, who said slavery wasn't so bad.
Exactly.
And I don't know if Ulrich Phillips was the guy that painted him this picture or who was, but.
Yeah. But I hear people say, you know, it really wasn't so bad. Even if we don't look at the series Queen, which was the next series in terms of Roots, which was the original series.
Uh-huh.
And Roots was a wonderful series in that it brought the issue of race home and the issue of history and all of that.
Uh-huh.
However, it was very damaging in the way that they portrayed racism. That the slaves were out visiting at night and cooking up dinner and putting on fancy clothes and courting and, you know, come on. Just kind of, I just really think that's an issue for me. I don't want you to romanticize what the real history is. And just to say a few kind of stereotypes. The stereotype that Blacks are, and so we are not more sexual than any other group. We are not more hot-tempered, hot-blooded, more emotional than anyone else. We do not have flashing eyes or flashing teeth, or we cannot throw daggers and, you know, all of the other stuff that I hear folks say. And also something that folks need to know, which I hate to say it because I think they need to know it, but we do not all deal drugs in America. You know, I know that that's hard for folks to believe, and we are not all involved in crime, you know? And let me give you an example of what happened to me very recently. I was coming home with the Dean of Students from the University of Chicago. we were in a car and we were coming from Wisconsin to Chicago. And we were talking about white skin privilege. And I said to her, it's white skin privilege when you can walk into a store and shop. And when I walk into a store, the security guard follows me around. And that's a white skin privilege that you have. And she said, Dorothy, I think black people are oversensitive about race. And she said, because what you just described is not racism or white privilege. What you have described is a misunderstanding. And let me give you an example, she said. Let me first start by telling you that the folks at the University of Chicago who commit the crimes are for the most part blacks. And that we had a situation recently where a young black woman was seen cutting through the library, and the library is an unauthorized space. And so she went on to tell me that this young woman was wearing traditional African garb. Of course, I stopped her to say, what is traditional African garb to you? And she said, she had on a kente cloth hat. So that's traditional African garb. That's all she had to have on to be in traditional African garb. And she cut through the library, and someone saw her, and they called security. And by the time she picked up her check, which is what she was going to do, and came back out, security was waiting for her. And they said, let's see your ID. And she refused, and they arrested her. And this woman said to me, see, it was a misunderstanding. I said, no, it was harassment. And she said, she should have shown her ID. And I said, no, she shouldn't have shown her ID. She was being harassed. And she said, so we got into this whole discussion of, you know, and her justification for it all was that black people committed most of the crimes on her campus. Therefore, black people should be searched more often, stopped more often as a precaution. So I could not make her see that even though blacks committed crimes on her campus, that all black people were not criminals.
Well, she didn't understand basic constitutional rights.
No, exactly, exactly. And I even at one point said to her, if I am a black person on your campus, what are the odds that I would be stopped more than a white person? And she said, four times as many. And I said, and you don't see a problem with that? And she said, no, because black people are committing a crime. So that's kind of another thing.
I want to get to something about that. It's ironic that, and I work on this with my own personal life, it's ironic that it's racist to deny, I mean, I know this is obvious in one sense, it's racist to deny our own racism. It's racist to fail, or not to fail, to recognize a certain level of racism in yourself or in all of us, but then to go as far as your dean there did, and say, well, this is racism, but this isn't.